Howdy. I'm Nolan Gray, Research Director for California YIMBY, where we're hard at work making California an affordable place to live, work, and raise a family. Welcome back to Abundance. In this episode, I talk with Jerusalem Dimsis. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic and a widely published author on housing and city planning, among many other topics. In this episode, we discuss how she became a YIMBY, the importance of the right to move, and why DC built so much housing, even if it could be building a lot more in the right places. In this episode, I'm joined by California YIMBY Policy Director Ned Reznikoff. And with that, onto the show.
Hey, Jerusalem. Welcome to Abundance. How are you?
Good, how are you guys?
Doing good. And we're joined by another co-host here. Ned, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hey guys, my name is Ned Reznikoff. I'm the policy director of California YIMBY. Also, know Jerusalem from some previous encounters, so really excited to be with you both.
Yeah, totally. Well, thanks for joining, man. Yeah, Jerusalem. You're sort of the, I feel like you're sort of the muse of a certain element of this policy space right now. I mean, the Jerusalem piece comes out on The Atlantic, and then there's like 48 hours of discourse, if not more, on some sacred cow that you're slaying, or some, in my opinion, rather obvious thesis that you're advancing that somehow generates a lot of controversy. Yeah, I'm kind
It's
of
actually
curious,
might
you
be, it's just things that I think should be obvious.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, but I'm curious, your path into this. I mean, so I think you've been writing a lot about YIMBY politics and YIMBY issues. I think we first met at the book event for Connor Dowdery's book, Golden Gates. I'm curious, how did you get into this stuff? Like, what brought you into sort of what flagged that this would be a good thing to spend, months and years writing about?
I feel like every time you try to understand the story of your life, you feel like, are you actually deriving real things or just imposing a nice narrative onto it? So, I think there's probably like two interesting stories that I think that have become more clear to me as people pass me this question more and more. One is that just I was in college and I was studying economics, and I read a paper by David Schleicher about how people in lower income areas were stuck in those economic regions because the cost of housing was so high and the cost of living was so high in economically productive regions, such that the wage gains they would get from moving would not make up for the increased cost of housing and other things. And I read that paper in 2017, just a few months after the 2016 election. And I think like everyone, I was just like searching for like answers, like what's going on here, like what happened, like how could there have been such a maybe a major shift from what our expectations were. And I remember reading this paper and just being like, haha, I have like figured it out and no one else knows. And obviously like that was like very much a college reaction to reading a single paper, but I think because I read it in that moment of when I was trying to really understand kind of like the economic divergence between different groups of people, and really because I was a senior in college at the time, and to me it was just like I kind of felt like the world was my oyster. I was graduating from college. I was going to go, work on policy or go work in, political campaigns or something like that. And I was just very excited, and I felt like there was so much opportunity. And to really see the ways in which the inverse was true for other people, and like the policy levers that were being deliberately pushed to make it that way, was just really interesting to me. And so that's like one kind of thing, like one piece of story. And then second is just like really looking back on my life, like it's like very clear that access to, more affordable multifamily housing in like very exclusive neighborhoods was really the reason why my life turned out the way it did. When we immigrated from Ethiopia, we ended up living in a pretty exclusive suburb in Maryland outside of Washington, D.C. And we were living basically in the only like townhome community in the entire area. And it was like at the time, I don't think I really thought about this, but it was where East Asian immigrants, African immigrants, and middle income people lived in order to access the really good schools in that area. And there was like very clear like racial difference between people who live there and the people who live in like the very large mansions very close to us. And then when I was in high school and my parents divorced, there was like this question of like, okay, my dad has to find a place to live. What's like within the same school district, so it's easy for us to get to school still, so we don't have to change school districts or something. And luckily there were like apartment buildings that had been built like within walking distance of the high school that we went to. And if those had not existed, I'm not actually sure what would have happened. Like, we didn't have, my sister, brother, and I, we didn't have cars, and my parents could not have afforded to buy us cars. And the public transit was like reasonably good in Montgomery County, Maryland, but like not good enough that my parents would have thought like, okay, you can just figure that on your own. And so it was a situation where like, when you look back, and I'm pretty sure this is true for like a lot of people, you can just really see the way that housing and land use decisions have just really affected every opportunity that your life, that you had or didn't have in your life. And it was just really remarkable to like think about the stuff that I was learning in school and really just realize, oh, like that townhome community doesn't exist. Like, I don't go to those schools. That, you know, apartment buildings exist. It's like a massive disruption in my high school education. And, you know, I think those are kind of like two things I've been thinking a lot about.
Yeah, well, and it's great. I mean, you're from DC, you live in DC now. It strikes me that DC is probably the biggest superstar city that doesn't have really robust housing discourse around it. Maybe that's not right, but I feel like we spend a lot of time talking about housing affordability in San Francisco, some amount of time in LA and New York. And then DC is like kind of floating in the background. Like, it's in my feed because I see the great stuff that the Nova YIMBYs are doing, or, you know, I've lived in DC in the past, but it strikes me that like DC feels like at the periphery of a lot of those conversations, even though it has kind of similar set of issues. I don't know. Is that your sense?
I think that there's not in the way that you're talking about, like there's potentially not as much YIMBY activity, but I think there's a lot of housing discourse that happens a lot in DC, both at the local and the national levels. I think it's often, first of all, it's still a lot more affordable than the cities you referenced, like San Francisco and LA and even like New York and Boston. And there's also more of a release valve in terms of like the suburbs. There's like, you know, you can go into Nova, you can go into, or Northern Virginia, or you can go into Montgomery County, Maryland, or Prince George's County, Maryland, and even parts of DC where like, you know, it's not cheap by any means, but there are places that you can find that can reach affordability for both younger new entrants into the area and for families. But there's also a lot of conversation about gentrification in DC for a while. Like, I mean, it was historically known as Chocolate City, and because it was, you know, America's majority Black city, and that has changed for various reasons over the years. And so that composition has changed, and the movement of Black DC residents towards like Prince George's County and now even further out into Maryland is like a really big part of the story there. I do think that you don't have like maybe like what's seen as a traditional like YIMBY story. I think primarily because that I think one of the big catalysts of like YIMBYness is you have like a critical mass of young college educated people who are finding affordability extremely difficult. And in DC, like there's, you know, Arlington built up quite a bit of apartment buildings. And I think that's been a real release valve for folks. And I also think that like, you know, as those people grow older and realize that maybe while renting is affordable to them, homeownership may not be in the same area. That's why you're seeing a lot more YIMBY activity in like Northern Virginia now than you had in the past.
Jerusalem, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the housing politics of where you grew up. So you mentioned you lived in this stretch of townhouses that were really the only townhouses in the area. And I'm just kind of curious. I mean, I, if I'm correct, Montgomery County is one of the sites where they've done actually existing social housing in the United States. So it seems like there is development happening, including multifamily development in some pretty exclusive suburbs. But I mean, what does that look like? I mean, is that actually the case? Or is it that the townhouses are like 40 or 50 years old, and that was the last time you could actually build townhouses in those communities? What's going on?
Yeah, a lot's going on in Montgomery County, and I think it really differs based on where you are. There's kind of like this idea that in like down county or like places like Silver Spring or closer to DC, often places that were considered more, economically integrated and more racially diverse, there were areas of these places that were more amenable to multifamily housing. And we've seen over the last couple of decades, even the downtowns of some pretty exclusive places like Bethesda have seen quite a bit of development. There's still like a lot of pushback. I mean, you have, you know, I think traditional like NIMBY politics going on in these enclaves, especially if you push that out towards like Ward 3 in DC is like bordering Maryland, it's like very near Maryland, and it's a really expensive part of DC, and you can really just see that like there's very little that's changed. I remember driving up and down the same road, and it looks almost exactly the same as when I was a kid, you know, like 20 years ago. And so I think that there's a more of a willingness to have trans-oriented development in the area, especially because we've just seen a lot of density required as DC hasn't been able to build up enough. And as I mentioned, like that release valve has really pushed itself into the suburbs, and they've seen prices rise. But, I think that there's like more policy experimentation than we would expect in the DC area and DC county, in DC neighboring counties, because there are just so many policy people that live in the area. And so I think it's like pretty quick to often adopt new ideas and changes that are being disseminated from policy leaders or the academy, or see lessons from other places, because people often move to the DC area from other places. So if you live in Montgomery County, you're probably like, you know, there's a high degree likelihood that you work in federal government, or you work for a consulting firm that, you know, contracts with federal government, or you work for, you know, a state institution that works with government politics. So it's like, it's really, really likely that you're going to see that kind of like policy diffusion and those ideas just diffuse really fast and rapidly. And that I think is conducive to much more experimentation. But we do have a pretty, anti-growth sentiment that exists also, as it does in most places. Montgomery County at one point had this issue where they had school overcrowding problems. And, you know, we went to classrooms sometimes in these like kind of makeshift structures outside of schools to create more classroom space. And they created there's like a housing moratorium for a while, because they were just like, we can't have more people moving in because the schools aren't enough. And of course, what happened is, even if there was a moratorium on building, and there's still a bunch of parents who want to move into the school district, there's still growth, because they just bought those homes at a much higher price from existing residents who no longer had kids. And so they had to remove that moratorium, because clearly, as we know, that doesn't actually work to relieve those pressures. So there's a lot of the traditional stuff, but I think there are reasons why Montgomery County might be different than a traditional, you know, suburb of a, growing city.
Yeah. I mean, on the Northern Virginia side, where I lived in Falls Church, Arlington, right at that border near the East Falls Church station. Mm-hmm. And, I had to walk from my apartment building through a single family zoned neighborhood to get to my train station, which I think everybody wants an origin story. And it's like, well, a bunch of little things bug me. And like, that was one, right? But like, even Falls Church is like an extremely wealthy suburb, and they're actually building like a lot of multifamily housing in that little downtown area. And that's kind of happening all across the Metro DC region. And so of course, like there are areas that over high opportunity areas that don't build a single unit, but like Metro DC is weird to the extent that you have like pretty wealthy, even predominantly white suburbs that build a lot of housing. And I've always sort of puzzled over why this is. You suggest like there's a lot of policy wonks, maybe like a lot of extremely online people in DC. I think that's probably a part of it, but I still don't feel like I understand like why. I mean, DC metro as a whole like permits a per capita rate closer to a Sunbelt city than like a New York or a Boston, like a Northeast corridor comp, right? And I don't know. I don't know if you have more thoughts on that, or if Ned has a pet theory.
There's also, I want to say, because there's significant like competition historically between like Maryland and Virginia. And Virginia historically was kind of like a more Republican state. Like now that's like much more up in the air. But even now you can tell that there's still statewide Republican strongholds. And like having a superstar city with a neighboring state that is like reasonably more conservative than you would in other places. Like you don't see that like in Boston or like New York or California or any of the other places where you have superstar cities. And so like having that, I mean, the most of the growth, I mean, there's much more growth in Arlington than there was on the, in the, or Arlington and Northern Virginia in terms of like larger apartment buildings than there was on the Maryland side. I think that says something towards the like relative permissiveness of land use regimes in Republican states. And also I think because there's a competition again between Virginia and Maryland on attracting more growth. I remember when I was very young, there's all this debate about like millionaires taxes and like how if you raise taxes in Maryland, people will just go straight to Virginia. And like that may be not true in other places, but because like Northern Virginia and Montgomery County, Maryland are like pretty similar on every single amenity, like it wasn't that hard of a switch. And so there was this kind of like sense that like there was a real competition for people and for tax base in the DC area because there was this ability to like switch over and still have access to like the same high level quality public schooling, really good accessibility towards, you know, downtown DC, all the amenities that you might want, similar types of like housing structures. Like you really were able to pick between like legal regimes in a way that like most people are not able to. Obviously I'm talking mostly about like higher income folks who are able to make that kind of a switch. But I think because of that like level of like competition may have spurred some of this as well. And also just like I think like DC in terms of like the housing price pressure, like I think really started feeling that like on a delay relative to the other cities that I think are much more further along. And so like there were, you know, the kind of like immediate anti-growth stuff that like comes up when people feel like there's just tons and tons of people moving in all of a sudden out of nowhere. Like that wasn't really, I feel like, the experience of DC, where like, of course there were more people moving in, but like DC had always had a bunch of people moving in. Like there's political administrations that switch over. Like there's kind of like a use to that kind of like cycle of people come in and then they leave. So there's like this maybe, I'm like very much speculating at this point, but like there's very much like this understanding that there's a level of churn that you expect to happen. And of course, like the visual landscape, like doesn't change that much given the Height Act in DC. Like you don't see massive apartment buildings, really high skyscrapers, just like none of those in the DC DC proper. And there was space to develop, like when you look at downtown by the wharf, like there was place to develop in recent years and in Navy Yard that weren't historically, you know, like exclusive neighborhoods. Like most of the building that's happening is happening in these kind of like downtown areas, and of course pushing now towards the more diverse areas of DC where most Black Washingtonians live.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, in some ways the DC development pattern I feel looks a little bit more like Paris than like most US cities, where you have a relatively dense but not super dense downtown, and then you can have some really dense suburbs. Like I'm just thinking about when I visited, I think it was Roslyn for the first time, and kind of like leaving DC and then all of a sudden being confronted by these big towers just over the water that you wouldn't really see in Northwest DC proper. It's kind of interesting. The other thing I was just thinking about is, so we talked about the high concentration of policy wonks in DC, and I do think it's true that having people who are interested in housing policy qua housing policy, as opposed to just housing policy as a way to protect their property values is probably useful. But I mean, the other thing that the DC metro area has is a ton of lawyers. And I wonder if that's kind of a countervailing thing. No offense to any of our lawyer yimbies who are listening
to
the podcast.
Some of my best friends are lawyers, Ned.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I know Nolan had Chris Elmendorf on. He's a great lawyer. But I mean, it is true that lawyers as a class tend to really like process and tend to think that the problem with a broken process is that there's just not enough process. And I think that sort of lawyer-brained approach to housing policy, especially in an area like DC, you would expect worse housing outcomes because you would have constant, endless discretionary, like it would look more like the California or like the Northern California approval process.
Yeah, and you should definitely have Alex Baca from Greater Washington on the show at some point to talk about this in particular, but DC doesn't have like the same project by project review that these other cities do. I'm actually not sure as to why the historical reason for that is, but obviously when you don't have that kind of like project by project review, it becomes much more difficult to stymie like every single potential housing development in the same way. But we do have our like pretty insane fights. Like McMillan Park is like a literal just dead zone of grass that has been attempted to be developed for years now. And there's just like a very large anti-housing like coalition that's built up to save McMillan Park. And I really just want people to go on Google Maps and look at what this quote unquote park is. It's just like, it's fine. And DC also has just like tons and tons of park space in a way that I think a lot of people who haven't been here maybe won't appreciate, but there's like lots of green space available, especially in this area that we're talking about. So you do have the traditional stuff, but yeah, I agree. Like, I think that maybe the lawyer procedural stuff is stymied by or hampered by the relatively unencumbered process of getting something developed in DC. But I also think that like part of this is also you both are coming from maybe more of like a California like West Coast or even New York perspective, where it's just is so bad that like things like DC feel like really great. And I think that when I remember when I first went to San Francisco after having really thought about and learned about these issues, I just realized like how much better DC was than like San Francisco. And I remember just like, you know, taking the train to Oakland and walking just a few blocks and realizing like, oh, like if I just taken the train to Rockville, like this would be pretty dense. And that's kind of like the spatial reasoning of that like realization, which is like, it's quite bad in these cities that we're talking about. That's why they end up dominating the conversation. I think often people think it's like for other reasons, but it really just is worse in like San Francisco and Los Angeles than it is in other places.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think there is something to the public policy sort of cluster argument, right? I think that there are a lot of people in DC who probably are like, they're civil servants and they're like deferential to like a civil service that actually works and maybe realize like some of the shortcomings of having a system where, you know, you've weakened your planning capacities off, you know, planning offices' capacity to actually do some of this work, right? So, I mean, in DC, right, you know, a lot of private applications don't even go to city council. It's totally apolitical. And if the city planning commission says, hey, this is compliant with our comp plan, they approve it. So you don't really get like, it seems like they've done that. I'm here in Vancouver where the city has built a lot of housing, but it's been this grand compromise where they built tons of housing on commercial corridors and in former industrial areas. And then like basically nothing in the sea of single family around these pods. Right. And it strikes me that DC has kind of embarked on a similar sort of grand compromise. Right. So like, you know, the areas around transit in Maryland or Virginia get intensively built up and then the corridors get built up. But no, we're not touching your Northwest DC single family home. And don't worry, you know, area right next to Amazon HQ2, we're not going to build a single fourplex near you. But what I think is interesting is that like, I mean, two things. One, the city, especially DC, defaults to historic preservation because their zoning is maybe a little bit more flexible so that you get these most like, if DC has a monopoly on any form of like NIMBY insanity, it's like historic preservation, like completely untethered from reality. But two, I think you're starting to see like YIMBY things crop, like the Northern Virginia push to have citywide fourplexes, right? It's kind of like maybe the death of that grand compromise. And, you know, we're like entering maybe a new like land use paradigm in Metro DC.
Yeah, Arlington County votes Saturday. I don't know when this is going to air, but Saturday, I think March 18th, submitted March 18th, to about whether or not they're going to allow sixplexes across the county. And a lot of it's transit-oriented development, but it's a pretty big, you know, potential change. And, you know, one that is particularly interesting because it's, there's a quite a like broad coalition that seems to have like sprung up, like the local NAACP, like it's like religious faith organizations and, are all on the side of the sixplexes and for upzoning, and you have on the opposition, it's really just kind of like, you know, it's mostly just like homeowners in local area, and like often, I mean, there's obviously like some insanity, like you'll always find these public meetings, but it's just I've observed a lot of public meetings at this point, like quite a few, especially virtually. And, you know, it's not as, the tenor is not as insane as like what I would likely expect to see if this was the same consideration in like a New York City or an SF or something like that. It's just much less crazy.
Much less crazy. Yeah, that's got to be the official motto of DC. You know, maybe changing gears.
Only on this, though.
Oh, right. Yes, of course.
Yeah. Much less crazy municipal politics. Much federal politics. Yeah.
Changing gears a little bit. I think this came up in some of what you said so far. It strikes me that like a through line in some of your more recent work is like the ability of people to move is really important. So I was reading some of your recent work in preparation for this talk, and you know, it's a lot of good housing stuff. And then there's this piece on occupational licensing, right? Which sort of seems like a little bit of, you know, like I think I see some of the common themes there, but, and I'm thinking like, you know, where does this fit into the sort of thought process here? And I think one of the things that you stress is that these things make it really hard for people to move. And so like people get stuck in the places where they are. I'm curious kind of to hear your thoughts on that. Like why care? Cause there's certain like, you know, every time I say something about this, and I'm sure you experience the same thing, people say like, oh, well, great. Like people should stay in their community and be rooted and, you know, like build up where they are instead of just, you know, moving and abandoning these places. I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, so, I mean, I'm a refugee, my family are refugees. So like the right to move is something that's extremely important and integral to like my entire politics. And my dad actually told me the story. I think he was in college at the time. And so he grew up in Eritrea, but it was when he was growing up, it was under communist Ethiopia rule. And he remembers reading sometime when he was like 18, 19 or something, this concept of like, there was like a Geneva Convention like booklet that he found, and he was on like some concept of freedom of movement. And it was something that he like never even considered. It was something that was like, he didn't understand that was a thing that you could even like expect to have or demand from your government. And it was like something that really stuck in his head as just like, oh, of course, this is like foundational. Like this is a right that is not present in my own life. Like they are something where, you know, there are really strong internal controls about where people could move around to. There were controls around whether he could even attend university in Asaba. And when he did attend university, like he ended up getting to study what he wanted, but the government told them what to study. So there's a lot of stuff around like what you were, this very basic freedom of like, can you go somewhere? And I think people put this in tension with community a lot, but I think that's actually like not how I tend to think about it. Like people are inherently like want to be around their family. They want to be around their friends. They like the idea of having, I mean, people are very stability oriented. We talk about this a lot in housing politics, and especially as you get older, like you kind of like things to stay the same. Like this is the idea that people aren't gonna be oriented towards community naturally isn't true. But I think it actually should be a free choice to be oriented, like which community you want to be in at that moment. And I think that makes communities stronger when they don't have like kind of a monopoly over the people that just happen to be born there or happen to reside there for whatever reason. And I think that's like clearly true when you can choose where you're living, that you're more invested in it versus if you're just kind of forced into that kind of life. And so I think that that's one thing that's really important. But I think the other thing is just like every other freedom and political freedom, I think kind of like at some level, like rests on your ability to like meaningfully exit the situation, because there's no way to ever exist in a community that is so fully homogenous that every decision that you're making has unanimity from everyone within that community. And so what that means is like, there has to be something to do if you reach a level at which you're like, okay, I'll care about this, but like, I'm like, at this point, I have to like find some other place to go to in order to fulfill whatever like legal, requirement I'm looking for. And I think this is like really clear when we're looking at abortion politics right now. Like I wrote a story last summer about how, you know, there's all this stuff coming out from, blue state governors that are like, we're going to be safe havens. Like we're safe havens for women. And to me, it's like, that's like not like super meaningful to me, because the idea that like a woman is going to be able to just like take a $600 flight to another state, or like find access to those resources is just like not actually real. But it is real that like people, there are a lot of people who would like move to these states for both economic opportunity and for these rights if that was available to them. And we're seeing not only that people would move, but that like these states are actually pushing out like middle income people who are not going to, like, you know, areas or regimes that have the same kind of, like, liberal, amenities, but to, like, places like Texas and, like, Arizona and, you know, you're, like, also seeing growth in places like Tennessee or in Florida, where they're being forced to choose between their own, you know, the literal financial benefits they can get from a job and from being able to own a house, and choosing for their future, for their, maybe their daughters or their sons, or, you know, if they have LGBTQ kids, like, you're choosing between these two things, and, like, that shouldn't be a choice. And so I kind of, like, gone on a little tangent here, but I do think that the fundamentally here, when we're talking about freedom of movement, you're really talking about, like, freedom to pick what kind of life you want to live, because I think you actually really raise the stakes of community choices and decisions to a really unhealthy level when you remove the possibility of meaningful exit or entrance. Because, you know, now if my community, you know, if for some reason I can't leave my, like, town or whatever, and they choose something differently to me, that's, like, a much bigger deal if I can't just, like, go to the next town and get, like, the school system that I want there. Like, I don't like charter schools or whatever it is that we're all voting for. Then if, like, you know, like, okay, fine, like, you don't like this, you're going to choose charter schools, and that's, like, mildly irritating to me, but, like, you know, I can have some sort of exit to that. So I do think that a lot of my politics is really based on this idea that you have to really, really protect this freedom of movement, both for when we're talking about people immigrating from outside the country, but also within.
Yeah, two quick thoughts on this. You raised the mobility in response to changes in abortion laws. I mean, I thought about this when they were resettling a bunch of Afghani refugees, right? And there wasn't, like, a single city in California that was, like, receiving refugees because it was just so expensive. And I think the State Department even, like, put out, like, a warning to refugees, being like, hey, just a heads up, like, we know you've seen California in the movies and stuff, but, like, it's going to be very hard for you if you move there. So, like, go to, like, unsexy Georgia or Texas, right? Because then you can actually afford, like, a decent apartment. And it just bugged me because it's so in tension with the stated values of a place like California. And I'm struck by how little soul searching it seems to, like, spark among folks here, and that, like, you still, like, reforms are still, like, this sort of, like, outside the mainstream sort of push. I think people don't really, the second thing I'll say on this too is that, like, if you're from a dying place or have spent a lot of time in a dying place, like, people who kind of get stuck there because they can't afford to move, like, they don't, like, say, oh, cool, like, I'm gonna, like, build this place up and fix it. They get hopeless, right? Like, you know, you can go to communities in the Rust Belt or in Central Appalachia near where I'm from, and, like, yeah, people get stuck there and they don't say, like, cool, let's, like, plant some flowers and, like, you know, start some small businesses. They like, kind of lose hope and start to develop, like, substance abuse problems, and as opposed to some of the members of the family who are able to get away and just can dramatically increase their quality of life, right?
And it's, like, a really hard problem, because obviously, like, there's never going to be a situation where, like, everyone moves. Like, there's always going to be people who are left behind in these areas, whether because they have really strong ties to them or because there's, like, no opportunity for them to go somewhere else. And it's a really, really difficult both economic and political problem, because we don't know what to do with, I mean, to me, the answer is obvious. Like, it's just, like, you should have more immigration and you should, like, revitalize these communities through immigration. Like, it's actually, like, quite a simple fix. If, you know, we have a lot of people who want to live here, and we could make that problem, you know, disappear pretty fast. But, like, given the political constraints and the realities of, like, things like Heartland visas, where you would kind of push these people to live in these kind of declining towns, or it's just not really politically popular right now, it becomes a very difficult problem, because we don't know how to make cities shrink. And, like, that's both, like, these small towns, but also, you know, even bigger cities and areas where you see declining population loss. Like, we don't know how to make city governments, like, shrink in response to that. Like, there's a pretty good paper I can, like, send it to you guys to put in show notes about, like, how it's, you know, cities' growth of public employees tends to grow, like, pretty linearly as the population grows. But, like, that doesn't happen at all, basically, when it shrinks, because it's just really, obviously, people don't want to, like, fire people, and you're, like, people are often worried, like, maybe it's cyclical, maybe it'll be demand back, and you don't have to, like, fired everyone just because of, like, a small downturn, and or reallocated them towards, like, higher growing parts of the state. Or even, like, you look at, you know, states like, you know, Connecticut or Massachusetts, where there's been a real depopulation in, like, parts of the state, but, like, a real growth in population in other parts of the state. And, you know, these city townships and stuff and like these local government institutions like often just continue to exist in perpetuity, and they're representing like just very few numbers of people, and you would hope that that would lead towards like growth-oriented policies, but you don't get that, and that obviously can lead to a lot of problems. Like when you have like vacant housing and like a bunch of blight happening in your community, like I grew up in Maryland, obviously, so Baltimore, this has always been a really big discussion of, you know, what to do with this real stock of like vacant housing, which becomes like a real blight to neighborhoods. And like entire mayoral races are decided on like how many, I'm exaggerating here, but like are decided on like how many like homes, vacant homes can be demolished in the communities. And it's because like there's they're causing massive problems in the area, whether it's health and safety stuff or landlords not taking or property owners not taking care of these areas. So it's like a real issue, and I think it's, you know, it's a real problem because you obviously don't want to make this a choice for people, like, okay, you have to get out now, there's nowhere for you to live here. But we also don't have like good policies outside of immigration to revitalize communities, because, you know, I think another big part theme of my work is just like cities and like towns and like country, these are about people. The built environment is a byproduct of like people coming in and choosing to live there and choosing to like create there. And so if you don't have that like growing sense of people wanting to be in a place and trying to come in and like that kind of churn and like the negotiations between different types of people, like you're not going to get any, like there's nothing to do about that. That's like that is the fundamental problem of, you know, politics.
Yeah, don't even get me started on Connecticut. That's my home state, and it's just it's an appalling situation there. I'll just leave it there. I mean, one thing I was thinking about while listening to you guys talk about this question of mobility is that I think the way this conversation often gets framed is that someone grows up in point A and then they move to point B and they're just there forever, and point A has lost someone permanently. But I think, you know, I'm 33, and I'm kind of around the age where some of the people I know in the Bay Area are talking about settling down somewhere, you know, having kids soon, and you know, there's a lot of them are talking about, oh, well, maybe I'll move back to my hometown, be closer to my parents, like raise a kid there. I think something that we've maybe lost sight of a little bit is that it's entirely normal and, you know, in some ways, a good thing for people to move to a major metro area, gain some work experience, raise their income, and then take that back either to wherever they came from or somewhere new.
Yeah, totally. I think it's like, very clear that there's a lot of people who would move back closer to their parents. And I mean, one of the things I think is one of the most interesting political developments is like the growth of AARP as a real partner on trying to push for increased density and housing options in a lot of these communities. Because like, as you guys know, like you have all of these seniors who want their kids to be able to move back to be near them, or even more seriously are kind of just like stuck in these homes where maybe they pay off the mortgage, but the property taxes are too high and they'd be fine downsizing, but like remaining in their community, but there's nowhere for them to remain in their community that isn't a similarly sized expensive house. And then of course, like there's a bunch of disability issues. Like they can't even use like half their house. They can't access maybe the bathrooms on the second floor. It's a real problem, or they can't go to their bedroom, they're sleeping on the couch. Like it's one of those things where, you know, often this is like framed, and like even in my own writing is framed as like, oh, like there's like this more stable generation that's getting all the benefits here, and like everyone else is kind of losing out. But like people are often also really bad at seeing how in the future this is going to harm their own lives, not even the people who are connected to them. And when you oppose kind of multi-family housing, like how much it will impact your own ability to remain stable in your community. Like it's not even just like a movement question. It's like, it's a stability question for you.
Yeah. And I mean, just to add on to that, home healthcare workers and just other basic services. I mean, in some of these, thinking about Connecticut again, some of these small towns that are essentially churning into colonies of affluent people who are 70 plus, I mean, they've got money, but they're nowhere near people who can provide medical care.
Yeah. I mean, it's like one of those things where, I mean, you saw this during the pandemic when there were quote unquote worker shortages of people in the service industry, and people were like talking about seeing like quality declines and things they were used to getting, whether it was in restaurants or in hotels or whatever it was, because a lot of people were being retrained or there were just fewer workers available to be able to do the same job and meet the same demands. And like, if you're in Vail, like, where are you supposed to live if you like work in a hotel? Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's like a real problem. And I would hope that would push people towards a lot more like, you know, inclusive policies here. I think one of the things that we're probably going to be seeing a lot more of, which I think, you know, depending on how you do it, can be good, but it's going to be like workforce specific housing, which I feel like can go in a very bad direction of like just kind of creating these like not really allowing people to create homes somewhere, but just like, oh, here's like workforce housing for our police department and for our teachers and for like the, you know, maid service who lives here or whatever. But hopefully I think it will encourage at least like in some places, I think it's encouraging some like ADU bill favorability, because people are like, oh, okay, well, like, yeah, you know, I'm 75 years old. I need a home in home, like healthcare worker. And, you know, they can live in an ADU that exists in the area. That makes sense to me versus, you know, this broad growth. But, you know, I think it becomes very hard when the conversation becomes geared around like, okay, well, how can we build housing for just like this specific population? Because then it just ties those people to those roles again, because what if you're a teacher who decides like, oh, you love it here, and like, now you're going to like work in a different industry, like you have to give up your housing now. Like, we already hate how jobs are tied to healthcare. We're gonna make jobs tied to healthcare and to housing. Like, it just feels like there's a dangerous slippery slope there where you focus on this sort of like industry oriented housing, but you know, it can be done well.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a deeply imperfect kludge, right? Yeah, and I think too, I mean, I'll never oppose one of these projects when like someone's bringing them up. Like, if you're like, there was a Mid Peninsula project recently that was teacher housing, and it's like, okay, great, like, sure, I'm not opposed to that project, but like, if you have a healthy housing market, a teacher should have no problem going out and finding a market rate apartment or home. Like, there's no discourse around dedicated teacher housing in like Dallas or Nashville, right? Because a teacher can just go out and decide where he or she wants to live. And like, to my mind, you know, maybe this is like a stopgap for like, or in a place like Vail, right? Or a place like Jackson, you probably are just going to have to build workforce housing because it's going to, I do think actually those places could build themselves back up to a place where like they're broadly affordable to many people, but it's probably not going to happen in the near term. And you need people to like run the ski lifts and, you know, work the McDonald's, right? So you're just going to have to build workforce housing. But like, the idea that major cities like places in the Bay Area are thinking they need to do this, it's like, you are not a like mining colony. You are not like a like remote resort community. Like, you're a big city, and like, when middle income professionals can't afford a home, like, that's a symptom of like a much deeper problem.
Yeah, I mean, I agree in the long term, but I also feel like one of the big problems with, and that I've been talking about this a lot with a lot of city officials that I've been interviewing recently, or public elected officials I've been interviewing recently, around sort of like, yeah, okay, if it was like 30 years ago for San Francisco, or like 10 years ago for Denver, right? Like, having this kind of like broad upzoning alone could like reasonably soon start ameliorating the problem for people to be able to access this sort of multi-family housing. And there would already be enough existing housing stock such that, you know, no one's really being forced out if they're a teacher in their community. But at this point, it's like, you know, the kind of growth that you would need in an area like Northern California, or in, you know, LA or SF, or, you know, Boston or New York, it's just like, I mean, this is one of the things I think I diverge with some folks in this space, is just like, there's like some level of like stability oriented policy that you're going to have to do that's maybe not maximally efficient, but otherwise, like, you're not going to be able to keep many people in their communities. Like, teachers who are living in San Francisco are not going to be able to like afford a townhouse that gets built for the next like 5-10 years minimum, even if San Francisco became like Yimbytopia tomorrow. And so I think that's one of those things where it's like, I think that like, as a stopgap measure, as you said, Nolan, like, there's like some value to these kinds of policies. And I think it's also valuable to show people that the housing you're building actually can directly impact their quality of life immediately, rather than just having to depend on this, like, people buying into this long-term growth story about like you know, about like filtering and like the Helsinki study or like whatever, which I feel like is just really not resonant to regular people who maybe are like, you know, open to more housing and are not like NIMBYs themselves, but just don't see how these policies help them in the immediate term. This is like why like NIMBYs have found a lot of success in making these arguments around like teacher housing and public sector employee housing and, you know, senior housing. Is they did point out these populations that are directly being affected by the problem right now and how they could be benefited. And I think it's like, you know, probably good that there's some direct way of helping them, though. I just, yeah, part of what I'm saying, what you're saying as well, is just like, it's obviously not a real long-term solution.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think on this point, like my whole model here is that I think people support housing if they can imagine themselves or someone like them living in it, mm-hmm. or someone that they love, or someone who's going to serve them. Like that, those are the things that I think people make people support or oppose housing. Right. You know, I was talking to a relative about a new townhouse proposal near where they lived. And of course they were just reflexively like opposed to it. It's going to cause more traffic. And you know, the framing I took there was like, well, this is going to be housing for people who, you know, were like you when you moved to Lexington, right? Like that's, those townhouses are what a starter home looks like. And don't you want Lexington to remain a place that's affordable to people like you? Then like the, you know, of course, person still unhappy about it, but the views soften on it a little bit, right? Because it's like, well, this is housing for someone like you. Or I mean, I think that's the power of like the teacher or the police or the nurse housing, right? It's like, okay, this is a person who's going to serve me. And maybe this is like a very cynical take on like how normal people engage with housing, but like I think most people just say, okay, this is going to cause traffic, or this might potentially increase my property taxes in some hypothetical way, and they imagine some harm that's probably vastly overstated. And the only way I think you actually can effectively manage that is to say, well, there's also a big benefit to you with this, right? You might live in that unit when you retire if it's senior housing, or somebody who, you know, makes your life possible in this community could live there.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the classic problem of like building new housing has like very concentrated harms but diffuse benefits. And if you can make those benefits somehow more concentrated, that like helps counterbalance.
Yeah, the challenge here is that I think where the argument that filtering won't get you all the way, and where you do need more some sort of deed restrictions or subsidies, where that argument is strongest is with extremely low income people and ELI housing. And there it's sort of like the politics of it are reversed, right? Where people get mad if you build a 10 unit apartment building in their residential neighborhood. But if that's 10 units of ELI housing, they will just completely freak out.
Yeah.
And I did want to mention this and kind of bring ELI and homelessness into the conversation, because I know that a couple months ago you wrote a really great piece about homelessness and housing. And so I was wondering if you could maybe just kind of recap some of what you talked about in the piece.
Yeah, totally. So this is a piece called The Obvious Answer to Homelessness. And it's a bit like tongue-in-cheek here, because I think what's happened with homelessness discourse, or whatever you want to call it, is that people are umbrella terming literally every single thing they see wrong with like lower, like quote unquote wrong with lower income populations into that banner of homelessness. And they're, you know, they're saying, you know, poverty, mental health, drug abuse, you know, public safety, all these things are laid at the feet of this broad banner of homelessness. And what my piece tries to do is just like really taking it down to the level of like homelessness is like, it's defined in the name, you know what I mean? Like people don't have homes, and like you just try to fix that problem. And the problem with that is that there are not homes for them to go to. And whether that's because of, you know, now we have pretty good research like showing like that when you look at correlations between what states see high rates of homelessness and what states don't, and what counties and do and don't, like you can really rule out a lot of the classic explanations around weather or around, you know, drug abuse or mental illness. Like there are places with high rates of mental illness that don't see the high rates of homelessness. And so this question of like causally, like what is making this problem, like why are there so many people without homes, is that, you know, there are really high rents, especially at the very low level when you're looking at absolute rents, and when you're looking at vacancy rates at the very low income level, at ELI levels, like what Ned was just referencing, you don't have access to any sorts of shelter in high cost cities. And so And that's not the primary argument that I'm making there. And I think one of the big things, though, that I was trying to respond to is that, like, there's an attempt to try to, like, and, like, people who work on this for, like, Housing First workers or people who work in mental health and in drug counseling, like, know this very, very well. Like, when you try to solve any of these problems when someone's homeless, like, you actually, like, can't do it. Like, I just would, like, I can't imagine trying to do my homework if I was homeless, let alone, like, address a severe mental health concern. And it also, like, ignores the fact that, like, a lot of these mental health concerns are a product of the homelessness or are being created because of the homelessness. And I think this becomes a much more difficult conversation as we get to this level of entrenchment of these kind of for folks who are living in tent cities or who are living in unsheltered homelessness. And there's this concept called scarring that homeless researchers and advocates use, which is that, like, maybe you start off as someone who's homeless and you have no mental health issues and you have no issues with criminal justice system and you have no issues with drug abuse. But, like, as you remain homeless for serious amounts of time, like, of course that stuff is, like, likely or more likely to change. And so you could, of course, then get a bunch of new issues that you would hope the state could help address. But the fundamental problem here is that you are unhoused. And I think that there's just, like, a reluctance to deal with that, partially because people look at Housing First programs and they decided they failed because they're like, oh, well, San Francisco, California, New York, they're spending so much money on these, like, homeless services and on Housing First. And, like, everyone in the field is so Housing First. And yet, what is the solution? It's only getting worse in San Francisco. It's only getting worse for me in Los Angeles. And, you know, I think that that's, like, a fallacy because, like, you can't see the counterfactual without these policies. And secondarily, like, Housing First is a strategy that works when you also have land use a policy focused on Housing First as well. Like, you know, you can, I mean, I cite this all the time, but, like, the Los Angeles County, houses, like, over 200 people, on a daily basis on average. And more than that are falling into homelessness on a daily basis. So it's not that these people are not doing good work or making real progress in terms of the people who need help. It's just that, like, if you don't stem the flow of new people, like, there's no way you can address the stock of individuals who are currently homeless. It just becomes an impossible problem. And so I think it's really important to try to conceptualize, and I know, like, preaching to the choir here, but, like, it's really important to conceptualize, like, the number of people who are at risk of homelessness. You have to address their needs simultaneously to folks who are. Otherwise, you'll just never get to the point where you can really address the larger concerns people have. And, you know, and you guys know this well, but, like, it feels like right now what's happening with homelessness politics is that it's becoming not a question just of how do we address homelessness. It's becoming a public safety and order question in a really dangerous way, in which people are just like, okay, they reject the idea that homelessness is about housing, and they embrace the idea that there's something just specifically wrong with these people. They've, like, chosen this. Like, I even had, I was talking to an Uber driver recently when I was on a reporting trip, and he just was convinced that it was actually a very good living, panhandling in Denver. And that I asked him, like, oh yeah, but it gets, like, pretty cold here, right? Like, don't you think it's, like, pretty, you know, pretty hard for people to be living on the street? And he was like, yeah, but people give you more money when it's cold because they feel worse for you. And so, like, there are all these myths that people are building up because they want to be able to justify what is a pretty intolerant, like, system of criminalization that already exists and I think is going to only increase if there's not some real progress on the housing issue. So, yeah, I think that's kind of what the piece was discussing.
Yeah, I mean, a connection that I just drew that I never really thought of before, because you were talking a little bit about how your family were refugees to the US. And I think, I'm curious if this resonates to you, that I sometimes think that the situation that we've put unhoused people in the United States right now is like roughly similar to the experience of stateless peoples during the interwar period. You know, like Hannah Arendt has this line in The Origins of Totalitarianism about how stateless peoples exist outside the law. And you can tell because the only way that they can receive equal treatment from the law is if they actually commit a crime. And then at least that way, there's sort of like a process for like integrating them into the legal system. And it seems like we've kind of created a similar situation for unhoused people by just you know, by the very fact that, you know, they have no private domicile to live in, and in many cases we've made it illegal for them to exist in public spaces. And so again, it's this sort of like being completely, maybe this is a little too abstract or theoretical, but just kind of like completely excluded from the realm of normal legal procedure.
No, I totally agree. I mean, these one things that, I mean, it was became very evident during COVID, right? Where it's, you know, there had to be all of these specific like carve outs to try to get homeless folks their stimulus checks. And, you know, we know this in general, like getting a driver's license, like you can't get one if you don't have an address. It's very difficult to register to vote or to you know, get a library card or like a bunch if you don't have these addresses. And we create carve outs, like I think places that are sympathetic to this create carve outs to help homeless folks. But first of all, I think it can be often like, you know, quite like self-stigmatizing to like have to tell someone who's in this place of authority that you are homeless. I mean, there's a really great book by Jamila Mishner about Medicaid and about how the process itself can become so stigmatizing to people being on there, and the treatment of people who are getting these services is just so negative that, you know, you become less likely to participate in the political process and the political voting or whatever, when you are in contact with these systems, even compared to people who are in similar economic circumstances to you, because of how we treat people who are, in part because how we treat people who are involved in you know, getting social services from the government. So I think homeless folks often, like, their only contact is with like potentially the social services or with librarians often, who are the front lines of a lot of our social policy towards homelessness, our informal social policy towards homelessness. But yeah, I like totally agree. I think it's also just like you can't feel like community. It's very difficult to feel community, and that's I think why people feel a lot of connection to the encampments that they're creating in a lot of these areas, because it is sometimes the only community that they you know, have been able to access and maintain in a lot of for a lot of their life, because, you know, they haven't been able to buy a house, they haven't been able to stay rented in some specific area. And I think that if we allow that to be the only community that people have, we shouldn't be surprised when they're reluctant to leave it for an unknown, unclear offer of temporary shelter. I think you have to create those bonds of community much more strongly so that people feel willing and trusting in their local governments and local services to move out of that situation. Because, you know, I often get asked the question, like, why? Well, I know someone who like lives on the, you know, in this encampment, and like, you know, they've been offered this like temporary shelter, and like, you know, they won't leave. And so like, clearly that's the case. And like, half the time I think people are making up this person. So I'm not really sure if that's like all true, but, you know, there definitely are people who are reluctant to leave these communities because there's some level of stability they've been able to create in these areas. And they also, I mean, in many contexts that they know that there's not actually a place for them to go. Or when someone comes and says, hey, we have like one offer of permanent housing, and like you're looking around and like the social worker's looking at you and you see all of your community members who are not being offered that. I mean, that can be a very difficult thing to ask people to do. It's like potentially their family or people they feel like safe from, and they don't know what this change will actually mean. So I very much agree with you. I think it is really a destabilizing place to be for folks.
Yeah, maybe one way to think of it is we talked a lot about the right of exit and the importance of that, but I think what we're also talking about here is the right of entry as well. That, you know, when you're moving, when you're mobile, you are leaving somewhere that you have the right to leave, but you're also entering somewhere that you have the right to enter. And one of the situations we've created for unhoused people is basically a situation where there is nowhere they're legally allowed to be. And then the sort of informal situations they set up where they find a place to be, then, you know, state officials or local officials will sometimes just come in and throw out everyone's belongings and say, okay, you can't be here anymore even.
Yeah. It's I think one of my favorite stories kind of talking about this right to entry that I wrote was, can you get evicted for calling 911? And it was about these nuisance ordinances wherein people who live in a community basically can be evicted, or the most egregious case was there was a town that required you to have a permit to be allowed to live in the town, either as a renter or as a homeowner. You had to get like a separate like occupancy permit or whatever it was called. And the ACLU has done like good work on this, so don't worry, this is no longer this is no longer in effect. But essentially, the idea with these nuisance ordinances, which do exist in a lot of places, and with this occupancy permit, is that property owners would be held liable for any like quote unquote nuisance that happened on their property. And that could be, and often is, a woman calling for aid from her government because she's being, you know, abused by her partner or by someone else in her family. And so like literally calling the police, calling 911 was, you know, lodging a nuisance in that area. And so, and often this wouldn't even be a conversation between like the renter and the city officials. This is a conversation between the property owner and the city officials, in which the city contacts property owners and says like, hey, there's been like too many nuisances. You have to abate the nuisance. And it's like creepy language, really, right? Because what they're saying is get rid of this person. And there's like Matt Desmond, in one of his like older papers, like documents some of this happening. I think it was in Milwaukee. And one of the stories is just like absurd, where like the city official tells the property owner to abate the nuisance in some way. The property owner tells the city that like his plan for abating the nuisance was to tell his tenant to get a gun and to like protect herself and defend herself against her attacker. And then when she doesn't do it, he says, well, she didn't get a gun and she didn't shoot him or something, and so she's been evicted. And it's just like this like insane thing where like, yeah, like who has the right to stay and who has the right to enter a community is also extremely, you know, relevant to this entire conversation. Like obviously like segregation is like a big part of like a lot of what we talk about in land use politics. And but at the margins, like the right to stay is something that's like really, really fought over in a way that's like not accessible or clear to a lot of us who even if we're having, you know, maybe not the best, you know, quality of life outcomes in our homes, like we are able to find housing, we're not at risk of something so egregious happening to us. But people who are living at the peripheries, I mean, there's like a clear attempt to reduce the amount of transparency about how the laws affect them and how private actors are able to exploit them. And like, that's, I think, a very clear example of that. Another one is just like how, you know, the National Apartment Association lobbies against even the most basic rental registries whenever they get proposed in local towns, because people just do not want this level of transparency for low-income tenants. Because if we had that, it would just become extremely clear how many of their rights are being constantly violated.
Yeah, I mean, you raised something earlier in this conversation about homelessness that stood out to me. It strikes me there's a lot of conspiratorial thinking on homelessness and housing, right? So I don't know if this is like, I don't know if Uber drivers just spend all day thinking about homelessness, but I've had this conversation like 4 or 5 times in LA, you know, coming home from the airport. And right, you always hear the most bizarre, you hear things like, well, checks are going out, checks are being handed out. And if you like ever so slightly like scratch at the surface, like, oh, well, like who's administering the checks? Like what program is that? And they're like, well, I just heard that there was this program, and you're like, okay, well, great. Or, you know, of course the famous one, like everywhere you go, the homeless are being flown in from somewhere else. And it's like, well, where do these people originate? There's like some spawn in like the middle of Nebraska that like, just like people just fly out of like, but it strikes me, this touches on some of your other work with institutional investors. Like there's this absolute compulsion of people on housing affordability issues to like come up with these conspiracy theories that involve like bad actors looking in the background. And maybe I just don't think a lot about a lot of other policy areas these days, but it strikes me that this is like especially heightened when it comes to housing and homelessness. Am I wrong on that? And is there any reason why that might be the case?
I think there's like two separate things going on here. One is that people don't want to imagine that real poverty could ever happen to them, or real true exploitation, like what happens to very low income tenants, could happen to them. And so in order to imagine that, in order to make that true, they have to decide that there's something wrong with the people to whom it's happening, right? Like it's not like just the natural function of what happens to low income people in housing scarce communities. It is, oh, you made a bad decision. you are refusing to do this. You don't want to take your way out of it. You actually are making money off of this and you're a bad person and you're exploiting public services. Like, there has to be something there that makes those people separate. And it's like, I think the inverse of what we were talking about earlier around, you know, people are more pro-housing when they feel more kinship to that, to those people. And like, that's why it's really hard to get people to accept, even people who might accept, you know, some sort of housing in their community, like getting them to accept homeless shelters or to getting them to accept, you know, very, very low income housing. Like, it's just, it's much harder because they feel like there's something wrong with those people. And I think it's under realized, like, how often this is not just like stuff like swimming in the ether. It's formalized by our like legal systems and by you know, decades of judicial decisions that like call apartments nuisances, and you know elite people who have decided that there are certain types of people should live in certain types of areas, and that like mixed income housing, like that's like actually unnatural, and what's natural is separating people by class. And you know, like there's a lot of work and like intellectual work that's gone into undergirding this idea of inferiority amongst this population of people. And then I think separately, this idea of like, you know, this conspiratorial thinking towards you know, the drivers of housing unaffordability is not is often, I think, a reflection of like people's fear that what has to be done to fix this problem means them giving something up in a way that's really scary to them. And it's, I think, not actually very unique to housing on this level. I think this is often the case that people, like, you know, you hear that statistic, right, that like, I'm going to butcher it, but it's like 100 companies are responsible for 71% of like carbon emissions. And like, that's like a true thing to say. But then when you like look at the companies, right, it's like oil and like gas producers that are, you know, powering the homes and the cars that we demand and buy and like, you know, drive and like go to the gas station or whatever. And so it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, you want there to be a fix and that it doesn't affect your day-to-day life. And there's also like, I think, a true critique that's grown in the last, like, you know, like 30 years about this idea of like, there's a ton, or I don't know, in 30 years, but like, is it that since like the 70s of like regulatory capture, and there's a real like truth that there's like serious regulatory capture problems happening most often, I think, at the state and local level, but also of course the federal level as well. And people have taken this critique and just completely run with it to the point where they feel like there's absolutely no democratic reflection of the policies that are being implemented. But like, yes, it is the case that like Exxon has a huge, has like played a big role in like blocking climate change regulation. But like, if we're honest with ourselves, like we have not pursued as a democratic polity the policies that would make it possible for people to live without cars. So at the same time, like, this is also a reflection of the democratic will of people that they don't want to live in transit oriented communities, and they often don't want to live in or have blocked change towards you know, renewable energy infrastructure by making it difficult to build solar, wind, transmission lines in different areas. And I think it's one of those things where it's there's an unwillingness to accept that part of this is that we are afraid of losing some level of quality of life. And I wish that people would, because then you could actually make the argument to them that they're not going to be losing quality of life. But we can't even get people there because the fear is so strong that they need to place the blame in an area that feels like, oh, well, it wouldn't affect me. If Congress would just censure these 100 companies, if Congress would just like stop BlackRock or Blackstone, then everything would be fine. And so then that makes your life, your choices, your decisions, your built environment completely free of blame.
Yeah, right. I mean, well, I think reshifting this to where like this is actually enriching people's quality of life, I think, is a really important instead of underexplored avenue for YIMBY advocacy, right? I mean, I think like, I don't know, this is something that is maybe a little bit controversial, but in many cases too, like, it's not even clear that like building, you know, so for example, they've done research on what happens when you build multifamily housing next to a single family home, what happens to the price of that home, or even if it's affordable, regardless, it actually doesn't lower it, and actually seems to slightly increase the value of the home to the extent that it's signaling to the market that there's a lot of demand in this area and there's the possibility to build, right? A lot of the upzoning provisions that we're discussing, they're not going to improve housing affordability on the margin of actually lowering the value of a bunch of existing single family homes. Like, to the extent that a bunch of the value there is actually in the land, it's only going to potentially slightly increase it, depending on like how the upzoning is administered. But it's going to increase housing affordability by just having a lot more homes. So the individual homeowner is probably not even going to necessarily see their home value decline. In fact, that would be like sort of in tension with what we think we know about what happens when you build new multifamily housing in some of these areas. And I feel like we maybe put a little bit too much emphasis on like the, well, like you're a selfish homeowner, you know, like, why don't you just go along with this? We need to do this thing. And maybe you could say like, hey, this is probably just, you know, even if nothing else, like even if you don't care about the doctors and the, or the nurses and the teachers, and you love the idea of your kid being forced to move 3 hours away, don't you like, there's a small chance that like the value of this thing that you own is going to slightly increase. You know, but it's tough because that's like a very nuanced sort of approach to the issue, but I feel like it's maybe a little bit under sort of under an underplayed card on the hands of YIMBYs.
I think it depends, right? Because if what you're trying to do is to upzone a specific part of town, it obviously is the case that it should increase the value of those properties. But if like the goal of like most like pro housing policy is to like do broad upzoning to get to like long-term affordability, perhaps you don't see home values like decline significantly, but you should see like the hope is to see like very significant like reductions in the returns to these properties over on a year-to-year basis. Like you don't want to see like 10% appreciation on a year on a yearly basis, something like that. And so like I think like this is something that I was actually talking to some housing policy folks in the UK, and what they were trying to do, because I mean, if we think we have a mess, I think actually like London, just go there. Like your Schadenfreude will just be like off the charts. Like it's just so bad over there. But in London, they don't even have like really like, they don't even have like zoning the way that we have it. And so what they were trying to do is just say like, okay, well, what if we could get like street level voting, right? So like a single block could vote to like upzone their area. And you could then make, you know, like a developer could come and like make the case like, oh, like I can get this whole block of homes. That means the value is like, you know, 10x to me than what it would be if it had to maintain this level of zoning. And so then that block could like vote to upzone, and like it could be in the property owner's interest in that area. If you could get like a critical majority to agree to it. And so like there's like, I think like there's definitely like reasonable, like I think experimentation on this front, on trying to get developers, on trying to get homeowners to realize the potential property value gains. But I think there's like a few things wrong with it. One is what I mentioned earlier, which is that the goal obviously in the long term is affordability. And so like there's not like indefinite increases to the value of the property that they're getting. And secondly, I think that like this is one of the things that I've like changed my mind the most on in the last like year or so, is like I used to put a lot more emphasis on people trying to protect the property value of their home as a reason for strong NIMBYism. And now I still think it's playing a role. But I think like mostly when people say property value, what they're trying to get at is like they're feeling that they enjoy their community, that they like think it looks nice, that the kind of people there are like people they want to live near, that like it's like quiet and it's easy to park, or like not that hard to park, or like all these different things that go into like why I chose to live in a place. And you know, telling people like, oh, you know your house can be worth a lot, it maybe isn't meaningful to the population that wants to live there forever, or wants to live there for another 10 or 20 years, or wants to pass that home down to their children, because they don't really intend on ever accessing that wealth in any real way. And so I think it's like, you know, I think it's something that's interesting. I think people are trying to think about how to make that argument in specific cases to people, but you know, I don't know how persuasive it is to like large swaths of people who are concerned about housing in their communities.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're exactly right. And I actually do think we've dramatically overstated like the extent to which homeowners engage in this advocacy because they want to increase their home values, right? And like, and it probably has to be the case, right? Because like, if that was actually the game that NIMBY homeowners were playing, then they would see some of this data on like, oh, multifamily development near me actually increases my property value, and like change their views. But that's not the game they're playing. I think you're exactly right that more NIMBYism than we maybe have given credit is motivated by, I just don't want things to change near me, right? Like I came here because I wanted it to be a certain way. And like, maybe we haven't really like engaged with that view because it's, I don't know how you like, you know, you have to make a much bigger picture argument about what you should value in a community. And you have to make this big complex argument about, well, change is actually good and healthy for your community in the long term. But that's a little bit harder than having the selfish homeowner NIMBY who just wants to like, you know, get bags of money, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest tell to me about this when I was thinking about this question is like, if it really were the case that people were trying to just maximize property values, like, why have I never heard of like a single case where like a property owner went to their local city council for a variance, turn their lot into like an apartment building so they could sell it to a developer? You know what I mean? Like, why have I never heard of anyone doing? And maybe this the podcast will go out and someone will send me this like really strange case and I will be excited to see that. Or maybe it's that, like, as I mentioned earlier, our legal regime has made the argument so forcefully that like apartments are blights and like multifamily housing is blights and renters are like costly and like they don't care about their communities and they want to destroy your like, you know, exclusive neighborhood or whatever, that like people are just, you know, super confused because the experts have been making a really, really harmful argument to them. Yeah, I mean, I also think like, you know, part, a lot of what my work is that like, you actually don't need to convince these people. You just need to move the level of government that's relevant to making this decision higher up such that their complaints are heard but are not like, you know, completely veto worthy. Like I actually think it's quite difficult to make the growth argument to people in a meaningful way on in timescales that are relevant to them. I think it's something that you have to feel. Like people actually really do enjoy living and growing in growing areas where people want to live in your area. Like that feels really good when there's like new food and stuff and new like art and culture or theaters opening up near you. Like people actually really like that. And so like, I think you have to just like show it to them. And like, there are times in our history where we've done that and now is not a time that we're doing that.
I actually do have an example for you, I think, of a homeowner trying to build multifamily property. And it was at, I think there have been a couple cases in San Francisco and one in, I think it was Los Altos Hills recently, where someone was trying to build multifamily housing. And it like years of trying to get the necessary permits and everything and not happening, and then just waited for it to become a builder's remedy town. And then it's like, okay, now I'll just do it, but even bigger.
Wait, these were like just like regular homeowners who just wanted to like make a bunch of money on their homes? Like they lived like their own occupants, or was this like a second property that they had?
In the Los Altos Hills scenario, I'm not sure whether it was an owner-occupant or not, but it was, it's going to be, if I'm remembering the story correctly, it's going to be multiple units of senior housing now.
Wow.
But yeah, yeah, I mean, to your point, like the system is set up so that most actual property owners can't realize the value of their lots like that. Like he literally had to wait for the state of California to come in and say, okay, this city's zoning map no longer exists, at least temporarily, before he could do it.
I mean, I think that's why we have these rules, right? Because I think like, I mean, early communities, like they were trying to solve a prisoner's dilemma, where it's like, if you are in an area with high and rising land values, right? Like maybe everybody kind of wishes that the area would stay like a bunch of mansions on large lots, but they know that like higher and higher land values are going to increase the incentive for someone to defect and like build an apartment building. And like, you can go to inner suburban neighborhoods that were built in the night, you know, 19-aughts and 19-teens. And like, it'll be mansions next to apartment buildings. Like that's what happened. Like a homeowner was like, oh, like there's actually a lot of money on the table for me here. And it's like, yeah, like this was nice, this whole project of what we were up to with the mansions, but like I can make a lot of money and go buy a mansion somewhere else. And like, I feel like that's sort of like the cartelizing function of like single family zoning, was to say like, we're all going to hold each other, you know, we're going to tie our hands. Of course, like you can do, you know, nowadays we have airtight deed restriction and HOAs that could get you that without zoning. But like, I think back then there was this perceived weakness of deed restrictions, or there was a little bit more reluctance to have these things be indefinite. And so zoning comes into sort of actually stop maybe that natural impulse of at least a small subset of the homeowners to be like, cool, this property is really valuable. Like, I'm going to cash out and move away.
It's actually a very similar story to like desegregating city blocks. Like people were just like, well, we're all racist, right? Like no one's going to sell to any black people or like Jews or anything, right? Everyone's like, yeah, like I'm not going to do it. And then one guy's like, oh, but I can make some money. And so like, the color line doesn't hold at all repeatedly, because like even hella racist people will, and often they're like charging black families higher than they would have white families for access to these communities. They're making a lot of money. That's why you actually get these like much stronger deed restrictions. But even that really doesn't hold in the face of the potential profit. But, you know, zoning made it much harder to overcome that on multifamily housing versus just like a single owner occupant who's, you know, a different race.
Well, yeah, I mean, just, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. Man. At the risk of being really kind of trolly and glib, I mean, I think that goes to show you why I sometimes feel like some left NIMBYs are insufficiently Marxist in their analysis of how the market can break down certain barriers and, you know, turn all that is solid into air. But yeah, anyway, that's the sort of thing that I wouldn't put it on Twitter, but I just felt compelled to say in this podcast.
Yes, well, this is a safe space. All speculation is allowed, but as long as you're not an institutional investor. You know, another case on this that is interesting is when the Bloomberg downzonings were happening of Queens, what happened was as these applications were moving through the pipeline, some savvy developers started mailing out letters to homeowners saying like, hey, you're about to get massively downzoned. Your land is still worth this amount of money, but after this rezoning happens, your land is going to be worth less. And there was this big moral panic about it, and they were calling them like blockbusters. And like, it was just basically developers kind of just communicating to homeowners what was happening. Like, hey, just a heads up, you can currently build like a low rise 6-unit building on your property. And in a month or so, you're only going to be able to have the existing home. And like homeowners were like, oh, okay. Yeah, cool. Like I actually kind of want to cash out and like, you can build that sixplex on my property. But it was funny because, like, of course, in this story, like the developers are these evil people who are like, you know, exploiting homeowners on the cusp of like ending, you know, on the cusp of establishing this cartel that's going to protect their communities. And it's just kind of fascinating, right? Because there's so much planning. We spend so much time talking about like, oh, well, we want to like do maximum outreach and make sure that everyone knows what's going to happen. And it's like all these developers were doing was explaining to them, hey, you're about to get downzoned. Your property value is going to go down. Here's the thing you can do now. You can't do. In 2 months. But of course they're, you know, these evil nefarious actors.
Yeah, I think it's actually like it's very, very hard. I think I've been reporting on some like local development fights recently, and it's very, very hard to get people to have positive interactions between developers, cities, and communities. Because you've just like set up this system where developers are like these people who like swoop in and like take advantage of these areas and like bribe, quote unquote, bribe their way to like community acquiescence, whether through like, and it's a process that feels like very corrupt and bad to people, but they like attribute it solely to the developer's will and not at all to a system that's been really created to make it that bad. Like if you just said to developers like, okay, you can build anything as long as you maintain this much green space, you build this much tree canopy, you have this much affordability or whatever it was, and developers were just like clear and there's like very clear regulations around what you could do there, like people would feel much better about that process than, for instance, like a process where a developer comes, buys a lot of land, wants to build, people are like, no, it's not affordable, and then they're like, okay, well I guess I can make it more affordable, like, and then you just like, the developer is like made to seem like super like evil because like, oh well, now I knew you were lying, I knew you could do more, like, oh, now you're willing to do this much tree canopy, like, and then like this whole like interaction where the city is now trying to extract benefits on behalf of its residents, like the city then also looks corrupt too, because it's like, why did you agree to this original deal if you could have gotten all the stuff out of it, and then nobody wants anything built because it's such a bad interaction. And I think it's like often like one of those things where it's like, I think it's very not useful to think about like private entities as like good or evil. They are either constrained or unconstrained by the public, and like you have to be clear about what you want them and don't want them to do, what they have to tell you, what they're allowed to do. Otherwise you really are creating this space for like really you know, nefarious seeming stuff, which, you know, is being incentivized by our current, you know, development regime. And it's like, you know, I don't know. I've been reporting a little bit on Denver recently, and it's like one of those cases where you can just see when you're talking to community members why they feel so negatively about it. But like the attribution of the problem is never really on the process by which you're requiring development to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think to a normal person, discretionary permitting looks kind of like corrupt, right? Like,
yeah.
Here you have this developer like haggling with, you know, some bureaucrat in the background and a council member over what will and won't get built, and then you get all of these just perverse incentives that flow out of that. Right now developers have these huge incentive to you know, donate to local political campaigns and wine and dine to local elected officials. Here in LA, if like, you know, they're always talking, we need to limit donations from developers to deal with this problem. And it's like, well, this is a symptom of a deeper problem, which is that, like, if you're a council member, you get to decide what does and doesn't get built in your community, right? And I think it strikes me as not an accident that in a place like LA, like, there's just this incredible lack of trust with the council because they see this kind of thing happen over and over again.
Yeah. And it spreads to like community input process then too, because it's like you have this process occur that's like between the developer and the city. And then the city comes to the public and is like, hey, are you okay with this? And like every question you ask from like the community is like, it's just like becomes like, it just seems so bizarre. It's like, hey, like, well, why isn't it more affordable? Well, we, this is the best we can do. Like we talked to them already. It's like, oh, you already had this conversation with them. Like, what was that? Like, you know what I mean? It just like seems so shady. And like often it actually is quite shady the way that it's happening. Like, that's what's going on is that people are engaged. Like the developers do really have like strong local ties to city councils and to mayors. And it's just like then the community info process, like they're not doing it fully in either direction, like, right? Like I obviously have like written a lot about my critiques about community input, but like half-assing it seems like even worse than like doing the community input like entirely, because then you get a situation where you've empowered a bunch of people but you've actually not included them in a lot of the process because you realize that it's like you should get this thing done because you really need to build this housing and you need to make this happen. And so then like people have a lot of power but they have like very little full access to like all of the things that are going on. And so like they know like something's going on they don't understand or weren't privy to, even if it actually is a good outcome for the area. Like you are creating this like negative sentiment from the very beginning of this process that like, you know, probably shouldn't happen anyway, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, when I was at the Department of New York City, so right, we have our community boards and they get to render advisory decisions on projects. And of course, yeah, everything's been negotiated. By the time it gets to them, it's a complete application, right? And yeah, of course, there's no analysis that goes into what the asks are, the demands. This is all just very vibes-based bargaining. But we get to the community board and, you know, historically they had like three options. Yes, yes with conditions, no. And what we saw occurring recently was more and more communities were saying no with conditions. They're like, well, that's kind of weird, right? Like, what does no with conditions mean? And essentially what it was community boards wising up and realizing that nobody really would listen to them unless they said no. Like that was the only power that we gave them, was the ability to say no. Because if they said yes, but you know, we support this project, but we want to see a few small things change, easy to ignore. But no, it's like, okay, well now we have to make some concessions to them. And it strikes me that that's like a phenomenon that's true of public input writ large so often. Like we have these things where it's like, we're presenting really complex information, it's mostly already final. The only thing you can meaningfully say is no. And then we're surprised when we have these public hearings and people say no and they get really mad, right? And I think that's something you've picked up on in some of your work.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I love that example. I think it's just it is when you ask people to make a decision and you basically indicate that the only empowering choice is to block. That's just like, what are you trying to do with this input process? And I know it comes from like, you know, various areas, like often from really good places where local officials are trying to, you know, engage the community more or give them more of a voice or whatever. But I mean, even outside of all the critiques around like the underrepresentation of this population or whatever, like you are just from reasonable people, you are incentivizing them to only want to stop things. And it's just really clear that like when you look at a lot of these like measure like things that people are either voting on or like can block or like can protest against or for or whatever, like often it is what you said, it's like a very complicated thing and like no one's answer is actually yes or no. Their answer is like somewhere around like I want it to be this or I need to understand why or whatever. And you know, God bless all the people who want to get to the point where you can actually aggregate all those preferences meaningfully into a system. I am team just like this process does not work, but you know, it's just not possible. Like, I mean, like I've talked about Denver a couple of times here, but they're like, there's a citywide ballot measure now about whether or not this development, whether or not an easement should be lifted on a park to allow a developer to build some like, you know, various things, including housing, including like commercial stuff or whatever. And it's one of those things where it's just like, people, I've talked to a bunch of people, they're like, I don't understand what I'm even voting on. Like, what does that mean? Like, I don't want it to be a private golf course, but like, what is even this development? I don't even live, like Denver's pretty, I mean, I'm from DC, so I think of cities as like pretty small. Like Denver's pretty big as a city, like like land wise. And it's one of those things where it's like people who are nowhere near this development, who have literally never even set foot or like looked at this place, are being asked yes or no to like lifting it easy. It's like such a confusing ballot measure question too. It's one of those things where it is no matter what happens, I know it's gonna be like up in like courts for a really long time. But at the same time too, it's just like even the people who seem in favor of it often are just like really just like exhausted by the process that's undergone here. There's already been a ballot measure on this question before, and it's that also feels corrupt to people. Like I think that's one thing we haven't really talked about is like when things seem to like never end, when there's never like a final yes or no to something, nothing ever feels legitimate. Like your voice doesn't feel legitimate, the actions of your elected officials don't seem legitimate, nothing is final. Means that like what are you even voting on? What are you even saying? Like when you show up to this meeting and you talk like, oh, there's another meeting now that's been scheduled. Oh, now there's like, you said that was a final vote, but actually we're gonna have another vote on something that's like pretty similar, but like kind of different. It's just like, it really erodes the democratic process and democratic will, I think, to do anything like this.
Yeah, something that Nolan has written about in his book is how specifically zoning, but I think you could say it about these processes as well, has kind of replaced planning. And we need to bring back city planning, give planners things to actually do. But I think also a theme that I want to tease out in this conversation is the way that it has also really kind of replaced a lot of things that used to be public sector activities. I mean, when we talk about sort of mandating a certain percentage of this will be affordable or there needs to be green space involved, it really feels like a product of the way that, especially in California with the passage of Prop 13, we just hollowed out city budgets so much. And there's very little the city can actually do to meet the needs of its residents. And so instead of actually providing services, they just enter these sort of weird backroom negotiations to try and extract those services from private entities who have no actual real stake in making sure that they're provided in a satisfactory way.
Yeah, I think this is something that I could go on for forever about, but it is like very clear to me often how many city officials, many of whom believe very strongly in like the public participation process, feel like just so frustrated by how they're being asked to do their jobs. And I think just everything you said is correct.
In the home stretch here, I want to maybe do a little bit of a lightning round, if that's okay. Short questions, clear answers, right? What's your favorite city in the U.S., maybe besides D.C.?
Philadelphia.
Oh, why Philly?
I love the East Coast. I like bigger cities. I really enjoy, there's quite a bit of mixed-use development in Philadelphia, where you can actually really get... like my sister just moved there, and like basically almost every single corner in her area has either a bar or a coffee shop or something like that. It's like quite easy if you live in the city to like walk and get access to like everything you can want. I know like 15 minute city is now some like evil thing to say, but like, you know, I think it's like one of the things that's really clear. It's also just it's on the East Coast, like of the big cities, it is like pretty affordable in terms of housing, and that means that there's like a really like vibrant like counterculture that exists there, both whether it's like queer spaces or in like small little businesses and things that constantly are popping up there. Like every time I visit her, there's like always something like interesting and new being created there. I just really love the vibes. The vibes are great.
It's still super affordable, right?
It is. It is pretty affordable. Like they lived in Brooklyn for my sister and her partner lived in Brooklyn for like a decade. My sister moved there for college, and you know they make like quite high incomes like for you know the country. And they were like, even I mean I could tell the story forever. Like their rental housing was like ridiculous to me. I was like, it's the quality was terrible. And then they also were like never going to be able to afford to buy there. And so that's why they moved to Philadelphia like a year ago. So now they're putting an offer on a house. So fingers crossed for them.
If any Yimbys based in California ever want to make themselves feel just absolutely terrible, I highly recommend looking at Philadelphia townhouses on Zillow.
Yes. And they're beautiful. They're like very, very nice. And I think it's a reasonably integrated city compared to like what a bunch of other cities look like. It's, you know, yeah, big fan, Philadelphia. Also, the people are fun. You know, I don't know. People rag on Philadelphians. They've always been very kind to me.
Well, there was a survey where they asked people in every city, what do you think is the, or how would you rate the politeness or rudeness of your city? And Philadelphians self-reported their belief that they are the rudest city in America. So
that's the kind of honesty I'm looking for, though. Do you know what I mean? Self-awareness. It actually breeds more kindness than other places. So big fan.
Yeah, there were some places that I know are somewhat rude where folks rated their city as pretty kind. And so yeah, maybe that's just yet another, even when Philadelphians are trying to say something nasty about their city, they're showing you their earnestness, right?
Exactly.
Favorite city abroad?
Ooh. I haven't traveled a ton abroad, but like of places I've been, I really loved Berlin. I think for many of the similar reasons, but also just like I really love I'm a big history person, and Berlin has taken very seriously the public and private work of like having really intense museums and cultural exhibits, and I think like valuable historic preservation in terms of like, you know, I did this tour with this like local professor of history, and you know, it's just like integrated into the city, like places and things that are like really clear. It's also like a city where like if you were like someone who's like born in like 1910 or something, and you like, I don't know, like were like living and you're like 100 years old or whatever when you died in 2010, like the kind of things that like you saw shifts in politics, like the number of times your city was bombed by like different entities, just like it's one of those things where it's like this is just a city where like so much happened and such a short period of time, like that someone's entire lifespan could be like multiple different political regimes like switching wildly back and forth, and you just get like very different people living there. And it's also been like a very liberal city for like quite a long time, even under quite stressful fascist circumstances. It tried to maintain and work to maintain its politics, its counter politics, and it was like very weirdly like alone. Like when you find cities like that, like most cities are like, you know, like they're surrounded by like, you know, I mean, like most countries obviously don't have like multiple cities like the US does that are like very, very large. But like Berlin's like off by itself as like this like core city, and like the rest of like really developed Germany is like further south. So it's like kind of by itself. I mean, Potsdam's right there, but like I just find it a very intriguing place to be. And I've, you know, I'm hopefully going back this year. So I'll maybe have more informed thoughts then.
And of course, they have no housing affordability issues there. So what are you even going to think about while you're there?
Yeah, no, none at all. Actually, Alan Levy, who I've talked to, gets so mad when people talk to about Berlin being affordable, because there are apparently like very large NIMBY issues going on there. So Alan, if you happen to be listening to this, I didn't say that.
Do you have a favorite fictional city?
Favorite fictional city? Wow. I'm currently reading the Adrian Tchaikovsky books, science fiction trilogy about, well, I don't want to give anything away, but basically it's like, you know, there's an attempt to rebuild humanity on a separate planet, and the attempt to do so goes awry, or it doesn't, and spoilers ahead, I guess skip forward if you don't want to hear what happens, but essentially like the virus that they use to try to accelerate human development or monkey development or primate development on this new planet actually gets incubated in different species, and the first one is spiders. And the description of like how these spiders would like build their own like from their perspective how they would build their own like cities or structures or whatever, I found like very interesting. Lots of density in Spider Town. So
lots of density in Spider Town. Yeah, well, I mean it does strike, I mean, it's not an accident, right? The most urbanist superhero, right, is Spider-Man. You know, like his powers literally depend on high rises. So maybe there's some, maybe the spiders have a quietly urbanist quality, maybe.
Wow. That was really good. That was very good podcast hosting. You got really dragged me back.
Okay. Ned, I'll open it up if you have any interesting lightning round questions. This one I have to ask, do you have a favorite form of zoning reform, favorite type of zoning reform that's happened recently?
Gotta be getting rid of parking minimums. It's just like probably the highest value thing to do. If you could only pick one thing that you could have the city do, and you didn't know where it was, you knew nothing about it, it's just like an American city, probably parking minimums, right? That's the way to go. I mean, what would you guys pick?
Parking requirements would be up there. Well, I kind of was the only person talking about it. Me and Celine Firth were the only people talking about it for a long time. So I feel a lot. I'm going to say minimum lot sizes are kind of a sleeper reform, just because so much housing still gets built in the suburbs. And if you could just build on smaller lots, like you could just have so much more walkable and land efficient communities.
Yeah. What's yours, Ned?
I'm going to pander to our audience and say single stair.
Oh God.
Technically a building code reform.
The third rail now.
Yeah, strap in.
Okay, I was trying to think of a good lightning round question for you, Jerusalem. Favorite urban arts scene, either from now or sometime in the past, like some like cultural movement in some city somewhere.
I'm so the wrong person to ask this question to. Like literally. Favorite urban art scene. I literally have no answer for you. I'm very sorry, Ned. I feel like this conversation and every conversation I've had with you has just revealed to me the depth to which I do not pay attention to culture and art, and the depth to which you do. So if anyone was wondering, I actually wrote an article. I remember when I was writing my first article about gentrification when I was at Vox. And I got to the section where I was like talking about like aesthetic value of like different buildings, and I literally had to just stop and just say like, you know what, like I cannot pretend to have opinions on this. So like that entire section is me going like, I totally will agree that there are people who have strong, valid, and smart things to say about aesthetic sensibilities when it comes to like the built environment or whatever, and I just like, I don't have them. It's not really a thing that I've cultivated, so my apologies.
I think you're being too down on yourself there. I mean, First of all, for anyone who has never seen like a video interview with Jerusalem, she is a very snazzy dresser. But second of all, I mean, we're just talking about how we both think that row houses in Philadelphia are absolutely gorgeous. So you've got some
That's
eye.
That's true. They are very nice. Thank you. I appreciate that. But my, I think one time I was walking in the city with someone I was interviewing, and they're like, yeah, like everyone in Denver like hates this, like, well, I just gave it away. Well, but it hates a specific structure, and I'm not going to say what it is. And I was just like looking at it, and I had like literally just been about to comment about how cool this thing looked. And I was just like, uh-oh, like, it's not for me. Cultural criticism, the architectures of the world, architects of the world are turning over in their graves.
I sympathize though, because I sort of feel like, there's a lot of buildings that people are just certain are ugly that I just think are kind of interesting. Like, I guess I just like weirdness personally, like things that just stand out and look kind of unusual. I think there's like that doesn't get sort of talked about enough, maybe in like popular architecture or design criticism, just like things that are just weird and playful and fun.
I think maybe it's also like a time of your life that you cultivate that mostly is when you're attempting to buy a house, or like you're about to have kids and you're choosing a community. And like, I'm sure that, I mean, like, obviously, like, as I've said, like, I have like clear preferences around places that I like or like less. But like, you don't formalize those as much until like you are maybe in the home buying or in the process of life where you are settling down in a way. And I think at that point, right, like when you talk to people who are in the process of buying a house, the number of things that they've managed to like formalize into a checklist that I wouldn't have even considered like a real, like I wouldn't even consider it as a category of things to like to optimize for. It's just like very interesting. Like they figure out exactly what types of like floral designs they enjoy, or like they're very specific ideas about like layouts of the ground floor versus the top floor. Things that I'm sure that like if I was about to spend like $400,000-$500,000, I too would be like very intent about, you know, determining what was better or not. But as someone who's like rented my whole life, and like as I've moved like a lot between different rental buildings, it's not until I'm like living in them that I realize like, wow, that's actually like very suboptimal. Like it's actually extremely annoying to have, you know, your like a very shallow sink in your kitchen is, I'm sure everyone, it's like the most annoying thing on the planet. Like I cannot, I have to like wash your dishes every single day. Sorry, now this has become just Jerusalem's like rants about her housing situation. But yeah, I finally have like a full dishwasher in my apartment, and life-changing.
Well, don't get me started on the depth of American bathtubs. Anybody who follows me on Twitter knows I complain about this like every 6 months.
Yes. No, this is real. I like was looking at an apartment that was like really, really great, except for like the bathtub. I think like, I'm not even joking. Like if it was full, a toddler sitting up would be like half in the water.
Obscene.
What is that? Why would you?
What are regulators? What are regulators? What are regulators?
Exactly. I want zoning codes for amenities in my homes. Yeah. I guess it's like building codes.
Yeah, I'm agnostic as between brutalism and classical design, but the bathtub, yeah, I have strong preferences.
Yes.
On that note, Jerusalem, thanks for joining Abundance. This was great. Your work has been super enriching to so many people who think about these issues, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes next.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Really enjoyed being here.
All right, take care.
And everyone who's listening, definitely shout at me on Twitter. That's fine.
Yeah, where can people find you?
I write for The Atlantic, and I'm on Twitter at Jerusalem Dumpsis, but I have muted basically every notification except if I follow you, because kind of a crazy site. So please do not get mad if you have added me and I haven't responded. I probably just didn't see it.
Cool. Thanks again. Talk to you soon.